Thank you very much. Well, in fact, it's a pleasure because there are a number of familiar faces, some of my ex-victims, former students on programs I've taught here in the past. And what I would like to do before we start the class is do a quick poll to try some things out on you. So hands up, which of you have got these things at home? Or have got them with you? How many of you have got a PC with internet at home? Yeah, well, I would hope so if you're working this field. How about mobile phones, another scourge of industrial life? And how about a games console? I can see there's some good. Do you ever play, Bob?
No.
Okay. Just as a as an interested bystander, trying to see what happens when your boys are and their friends are playing. Okay. Now, if we do the same questions, go back 10 years. So, how many of you had internet access at home 10 years ago? At home. So, some of you did. And how about mobile phone 10 years ago? Well, at that time, mobile phones were sort of clunky things. They were very strange. At that time, an 8-bit or 16-bit console, different kinds. Anybody have a console then? Did you? No. 10 years ago, you're not really. Anybody? Yeah, so Sue did. Great. Yeah. Your children did. Okay. Then time, yeah. So the reason for the quiz was just to get you to think about what changes take place rapidly, what changes are more slow, and also whether a particular device has become ubiquitous, completely widespread, or if it's still a minority interest. So you've already shown that quite a lot's happened in a decade, but not so much has happened when it comes to video consoles. Some inputs. When I was here a year ago, I was looking at the newspaper and I saw this particular cartoon. It's a dad with his son. It says, "I win my game. Sorry, Bill, but that's part of life. You have to learn to be a good sport. Don't be a sore loser." Do you actually believe that? I don't. So this is what really happened. "I win again, Dad. That's four in a row. Boo, I quit. I've got more important things to do than play dumb games." That's probably a more realistic scenario than the first one. And then on Saturday, looking through the newspaper, I saw discussions about ethics and what goes on in classes, a proposal to talk about gambling, and one of the experts saying it would be a valuable exercise to stimulate students into analysing why there's such a controversy over soccer betting and to initiate rational discussion in classes. But even so, there seemed to be a certain amount of concern on the part of government officials that would be inviting, torching a very dry forest when there hadn't been any rain for 3 months or something of that kind. Something else I saw over the weekend, Angela pointed out, an internet content rating systems project, so that we can actually do something about declaring certain websites appropriate or less appropriate. These are two inputs I'd like to come back to when providing something on the use of media in school, in particular out of school, by children and adolescents. So before I start, just something about who I am and what I do. I work full time in a public service broadcaster. That's the Danish equivalent of the RTHK or the BBC. Unlike your situation, people have to pay nearly 2,000 Hong Kong dollars a year for the privilege of watching television. Most of that goes to our organisation. Some of it goes to the other public service broadcaster. And it's just another way of getting a kind of tax, but it's specific to broadcasting. Well, that also means that we're probably unique in Europe in that about 70% of the population voluntarily choose to see the three public service TV channels. So the remaining seven channels are fighting over the remaining 30% of audience share. So that's a bit unusual. I'm concerned primarily with strategy, market, and technology, and my prime concern at the moment seems to be digital TV and broadband. And you say, what the heck has that got to do with my work? And hopefully you'll see what it has to do with your work in a few minutes. For a public service broadcast, it's quite important that we're something for everybody, not just for a particular group, either an elitist group or an elderly group. If we don't come up with television, radio, and other kinds of offerings for younger audiences, then the public service proposition doesn't actually hold water. Over time, it wouldn't really be justifiable to ask people to pay such amount of money if young audiences don't make use of us, because young audiences at some point grow up and have to pay the tax if they've decided that we're irrelevant to their lifestyle. Then we really do have a problem, if not now, at a later stage. So we have 9 full-time audience researchers trying to help us understand what makes Danes tick, what they find interesting, what they don't find so interesting, and just to understand the people we have to serve in different kinds of ways. So that's what I do much of the time, but over and above that, I also teach postgraduate courses in the development of digital formats and strategic issues to digital content at IT University in Copenhagen, which is a new university which only has postgraduate students. It was set up at the peak of the IT boom in 1999, when everybody sort of thought that the IT development would just go on and on and on. And I've also been teaching here on Nancy Law's program and on Angela's program, postgraduate courses with a likely a professional sort of development slant. Okay, that's a bit about my background. I want to look at three questions. What do we know about out-of-school media use by our current and future students? What impact does this have on cognitive and emotional development? And what are the implications of what children and young people and later on the young adults actually do? What are the implications of this use of information and communication technology, use of media outside of an educational context, for what goes on inside education? So if you look at the have a seat, there's some seats over here if you like. It's a small place over here, I think, so you're welcome. No problem. What do we know about out-of-school media use by our current and future students? Well, first of all, start looking at the term media or look in more general terms at not just children and adults, but the population is large. And one of the things we've had to do fairly recently in the last 5 years is perhaps redefine the term media from being something we associate with linear content, radio, television, the cinema, newspapers, and so on. And we've tried to look at, certainly for electronic media, to some different categories. So we've looked in terms of watching and playing and connecting. So watching is largely a couch potato kind of activity, where people are relatively passive from a physical point of view. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're on power save intellectually. They may well be thinking and doing things, even they're just sitting back and relaxing. But even so, it's a relatively passive mode of consuming things. It could be television, it could be watching video, it could be watching pay-per-view video on demand. The second category is playing, which is in that it's not just computer games. We could perhaps say that the activities that young people do when they put together their MP3 libraries or charge up different kinds of music on the MP3 players for the week before going off and listening on the bus on the way to school or something of that kind, and then connecting, which is all about mediated communication, peer-to-peer communication, or peer-to-group communication. So things like, for you, it would be more like email, the web, and ICQ, MSN Messenger. In Europe, we'll probably have to rate the mobile phone and the ubiquitous SMS message and shortly the MMS, multimedia message service, as the things which are being used by young people. But if you try and just think about your media consumption over the last week in these three categories, and I'm going to show you how some consumption patterns in terms of time and money for Europe. So what do we spend our time on? These are the hours we spend per week. So typical, if we take the whole population, spending about nearly 3 hours a day watching the box. Well, watching can also be just having the television on, but not necessarily looking at it. Again, difficulties of defining these things precisely enough. So this is watching. The blue area was playing. That's surprising. There's more playing going on apparently than we would be led to believe. And then connecting in terms of time. This is for the whole population, not just people like ourselves, because we probably spend a far greater proportion connecting than actually watching. I think most of you will get home too late anyway to watch TV, and if you do, you probably wouldn't be in the mood for it. You might catch the late news or perhaps a film, but very little else. But if you take the population at large, and also those who aren't working at universities or aren't working in businesses, even so, this particular area is in fact increasing. That's going up. But if we look at what we're spending our money on, the connecting bit, using our mobile devices, using our phones, that's accounting now for the lion's share. Games, which take a fair amount of time, if you take the whole population, they're quite cost efficient. They're not actually taking too much money. And watching isn't something we spend an awful lot of money on. And it's interesting to see, for different kinds of media, when do people actually use them? So, for example, when it's Denmark, if it takes something, a good old medium like the radio. Radio for us is something which peaks about 7:30 in the morning. It's very much a morning medium. There's a little peak again for the midday news, and this is not normally people at home listening to the radio, but people in their cars or people travelling listening to the radio. Another blip around 6:30 when there's the main evening news on the radio, and then it rapidly drops off in the evening. Whereas if you take television, which is the red curve, so there's a little bit of breakfast news viewing, and that increases to in fact about 3.7 million, or it's about 55-60% of the population around 9 o'clock. And then if we look at the internet, okay, we've taken they're not the absolute values but the relative values. Internet is very much a day medium in Denmark. It's mainly because much of the internet use is in fact done at work or at school, or in some cases part of this in the afternoon is done in school libraries and in public libraries. So what we're talking about is activities which weren't there for the general population, which have appeared largely in the last decade. So using mobile phones, using the internet. If we're talking about the population at large, this is something which has developed in the course of a decade. But we're interested in kids, we're interested in adolescents, we're perhaps interested in young adults and what they're doing, because we might ask ourselves to what extent are kids the same, or are there any differences? So most of these pictures were actually from a similar paper which I had to do in Spain about a year and a half ago, so somebody actually went out and did some photographs for me. Let's take some examples of what actually happened. This is in fact 5 years ago, And these are figures for 9 to 16 year old kids in Denmark. Kids and young adolescents. The right hand column is for everybody, and this is the consumption in hours and minutes for those who actually carry out that kind of activity. So for television, as nearly everybody watches television, the differences are very small. So we start by reading. This may have changed a bit because of Harry Potter. Book 5, J.K. Rowling, perhaps with the Lord of the Rings, fighting a rather lonely battle to win the hearts and the minds of our young people around the world. So reading fiction, not reading school books, is something that the 9 to 16 year olds in Denmark aren't really doing a great deal of, unless they're forced to. So typically about 17 minutes. For boys, that's nearer 10, and for girls, nearer 30. Remember, there's still quite significant gender differences. Girls still continue to read in Denmark. But boys and girls are quite avid readers in Denmark until they're 10 or 11, and it suddenly drops off quite rapidly. But look at, compare that miserable 17 minutes with 2.5 hours watching television. Well, our triangulation with other methods indicates that that figure is in fact a bit on the high side, as is playing computer games. But even so, we're talking about activities using the computer at home for things other than games. We're talking about activities which are substantially more visible in the daily lives of our of children and young adolescents than they were 10 years ago. And that, so certainly that this gives food for thought. If we're saying that the printed word has been a vehicle of culture for, well, certainly for 130 or 40 years, it was for the general population, not for the elite. That's been an instrument of dissemination for a lot longer, but certainly since the latter half of the 19th century, books have been reasonably widely available, also because of the emergence of good public libraries in parts of the world. So we've got a problem there, perhaps. And what I now want to go on to talk about is some more specific research which was published just 2 days before I left for Hong Kong about risk behavior, and that goes back to the business of rating content on the internet, rating content in general. Just a little aside, about 5 years ago we have a Children's and Youth Council. It's an independent body which reports directly to the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister asked this council to have a look at warnings on computer games about their violence and other kinds of inappropriate behaviour on games. Their conclusion when they looked at the piracy figures was that it wasn't going to help to have a lot of ratings on games, simply because about 1/6 of the games in circulation at the time were legitimate copies, and 5/6 were pirated copies normally made by other children, and they didn't find any kids who slavishly photocopied the covers and the boxes and any warnings that there may have been. So their conclusion was that it was probably more important to do something for parents rather than assume that just because a rating was available that it would then continue along with the pirate copy. But I'm going to be talking about a project called SAFT. SAFT means juice, in fact, in Danish. It's a project covering all of the Nordic countries and Ireland as a kind of benchmark. What it's looking at is the realities of how young people actually acquit themselves when they're on the internet. And earlier this year they also did a study of attitudes by parents to the use of the internet. So they They interviewed nearly 5,000 parents. This particular study was conducted from January to March, and it covered a total of 4,700 interviews using a questionnaire. If you want to, you can find it, the website, which is in there are in fact six different websites, but this is the Danish one, and the reports were published also as a PowerPoint. Some of it's in Danish, some of it's in English. So where it's not in English, I've actually translated it to make it easier for you, because I don't think all of you understand Danish. So there are some people here who can guess their way through Danish quite well. That's impressive. Well, let's have a look at some of the findings they came up with. So if we take Denmark, we can see that 50% of Danish kids, this is all kids between the ages of 9 and 6, have got access to a PC at home. They have their own PC at home. And there's only 3% of kids between 9 and 16 who don't have access to a computer at home. And of those, some of them, not all of them, but most of them would actually have access to a computer for free, and a computer with internet in a school library, which is open after school hours. So if we take... that went a bit too fast. Internet connection, so of those who have PCs, which was nearly 100%, in Denmark, well over two-thirds have got internet access at home. So again, if we just go back 6 years, there was only a third of households had internet access. It's going quite fast. We can assume that apart from those on some of the 500 outlying islands, or somewhere really out in the sticks, just about everybody will have an internet connection in this particular age group for the next 3 or 4 years. So the issue of digital divide in terms of access isn't quite as serious as it used to be. And then we can have a look at the kinds of things that kids say they're using the internet for. I think you always need to take interviews with a grain of salt, but even so, these are Danish school kids, and they don't seem to have any hang-ups about being fairly forthcoming about their activities. So playing games is the most frequent activity, sending and receiving emails. Doing homework, depending on your age, in fact, comes quite high. So if you're in lower secondary school, then two-thirds of them are using the internet for homework. Getting information other than for homework on the web, that's about half of them. Surfing for fun, visiting fan sites, chatting, downloading music, things of that kind. Buying things on the net, 7% of those interviewed, they're minors, have somehow or other managed to do some sort of e-commerce transaction on the internet. Well, that shouldn't be possible, because they shouldn't be able to do that, but they seem to have been able to do so anyway. Let's have a look at gender differences. Girls, predominantly email, homework, information, fan sites. And then the things after are quite small. Boys, very different. Playing games, downloading music, surfing for fun, downloading software, sites for hobbies, watching porno, personal websites. If you looked at the previous one, about one in five of those interviewed were actually making their own websites. So that in itself is interesting. A fifth of the youth, younger generation, are not just using these things, but actually making these things. And if we look at, again, Denmark is the green figure, where do they get it, where are their main sources of information when they're doing their homework? Well, it's books in the public library. I think the librarians should be quite happy about this. This is not just public libraries, it's also school libraries. The second most widely used thing, well, the difference isn't statistically significant. 51% use internet websites, and just behind that, books from the school. And you can see there are significant differences from country to country, but the general trend is more or less the same. And now we're moving into the business of risk behavior. How well do our young people acquit themselves when they're actually on the internet. So about a third of the Danish school kids say that they wouldn't necessarily trust what they find on the internet. That they actually do, they take active measures to check where that information comes from.
From Finland,
yes.
I saw the Scandinavian country was there, but there is one.
Yes, because we talk about Scandinavia for three countries: Denmark, Sweden, Norway. We talk about the Nordic region, and we include Finland because all four countries were under the same queen for a period of just over 10 years, so, Queen Margaret the First. So we do have some shared history, and that's why. Yeah. Well, there are in some of the figures, but not all of them. And if you want it, you can certainly find this information on one of the six websites. So it's there. If you show all six, I'm just giving some indicators that this is to be illustrative rather than exhaustive, because it would probably take too much of your time. But just where would you find this kind of study, and what can we learn from it? I think that's quite reassuring that nearly a third of those say they actually do something before they will actually trust what they've read or got hold of. The other interesting thing is the proportion of the kids interviewed who actually talk to their parents about what they do on the internet. So in Denmark, it's 38% say they talk to their mothers and 34% talk to their fathers. We don't know if we can actually add them together, because it could well be that some speak to both their mothers and their mother and father. So it's somewhere between 38 and 72%. That's why I just added this on as a stippled number. Again, that's quite reassuring. I don't think Danish parents are quite as hectic as parents in Hong Kong, but even so, most middle-class families, 83% of women of a childbearing age, I think is the term in English, are actually in full-time employment. So it's we don't have very many housewives in Denmark, a lot fewer than we have in both the US and in the UK. Even though you've got two parents working, they're still actually talking with their kids at some point or other. But remember, we only work 5 days a week. I mean, many of you in Hong Kong are working at least six, and some of you in the private sector are actually working even longer hours at the moment since the recession started. And there's, again, just to point out, so we don't go into detail, the business of rules for using the internet. That in most families they have come to some sort of accord about what is okay and what isn't okay to do on the internet. So I'm not allowed to give out any personal information. That's half of the Danish kids. I'm not allowed to meet in person somebody I only know from the internet. That applies to half of them. I'm not allowed to visit certain sites. That applies to just over a third. Have you ever met anybody new on the internet who ask for your personal information? This is to point out that there is a risk, and this shows that, with the possible exception of Ireland, where the figure is only 1 in 5, we are talking about something that lots of kids actually experience. 39%, that's getting on for a half. So what the report concludes, and I've added some comments in places, because the terms of reference of this report was just the internet, and I think that's a bit narrow. So what they concluded is that kids, by and large, have their own net culture. The net is the current toy and medium for experiences, entertainment, communication, and network building. And I've added in Denmark, coupled with a mobile phone. I wouldn't say that, for example, because of the business of peer-to-peer communication, for young teenagers. From the ages of about 12 to 15 or 16, the mobile phone is far more important than things like MSN Messenger and ICQ. For those who are in last year's secondary school, this changes quite dramatically. And what they're doing is, it's always been the case that the transition from childhood to adulthood has involved experimentation, breaking new ground, and breaking taboos. This is still, this has always taken place, but increasingly this is taking place on the net for many of these children. It's not exclusively, they're still actually hanging out with their friends, but some of the experiences are of a virtual nature and not of a real one. And what we can say is that the home, the school, and outer school clubs have become transparent areas where adults observe and engage in dialogue with children on equal terms. So there are new contexts in which adults and children and adolescents can actually interact with each other. And these are not necessarily regulated in the same way as they would have been in the past, because these take place in a virtual space and not in a real one. So let's come up. I changed it this way, it's twice. So what inferences can we draw from this kind of study? Well, we saw from I mentioned initially the website from the Hong Kong Association of Internet Service Providers, and they laudably looking at quality media. So it applies not just to the internet. The same authority also looks at the vetting of content for other media. So it's given that kids are going to be doing this, they're going to be experimenting, this is a natural part of growing up, what we need to look at is the supply side. Can we actually make sure there is quality media, quality experiences, places where they can actually try out their newfound muscles or their newfound skills to do their thing, but without getting into difficulties. But the second dimension is the whole business of filtering. And this tends to, in my opinion, to be over-exaggerated. Filters can only help you so far. Any kid with a modicum of intelligence, and I would say this applies to well over 90% of them, if they want to, can get around filters. So filters aren't good enough on their own. Having too much faith in the whole business of filtering, having seen what we have about what young people are doing with the internet, will probably be an unrealistic strategy. So it's probably realistic to have a component in our strategy where we could by all means use filtering as one element, but we also need to look at the quality of the contents available, and we also need to see to what extent we should just nudge and jog and encourage parents when they do get the chance, their 75 minutes on Sundays when Hong Kong dads are with their kids, just to perhaps occasionally talk about how it's going with the internet. Maybe the kids don't want to talk about it, because I would imagine here, even more than is the case in Europe, they're using the internet at cyber cafes and other places simply to be out of the out of the loop where their parents can actually see what they're doing. But even so, it should be possible over time to have something to discuss. So parents and kids ought to be able to discuss this if showing some sort of healthy interest in what they're doing, and perhaps agreeing some sensible rules about what you do and what you don't do could be quite helpful. But remember, there are still parents who are not very regular users of the internet, so they wouldn't necessarily know all these things. So therefore, I think education has a very important role to play in helping kids, helping them to relate to media, in the same way as the suggestion about gambling. I wouldn't be so worried. I would think it would be quite a good idea to talk about gambling in the context of the school subject ethics. I think there's in the curriculum there's a subject called ethics. Why not? If it's something that has become controversial, there'll be a certain amount of interest. You can build on that interest and do something with it. In the same way, I think you could do your own quick and dirty survey in class of internet habits with the students, and then discuss some of the things they're doing by saying, okay, certain things are okay, but there are certain precautions you ought to think about, so that you don't end up on the front page of the morning newspaper or on the television news as one of these poor unfortunate kids who's actually gone off to see somebody they've met in a chat room and doesn't come back again. I think one case like that is one case too many. So if we can do things to avoid that kind of incident occurring, I think we ought to be able to do it. So my suggestion is that filtering and putting ratings on contents are good beginnings. They're important elements, but the two elements that seem to be lacking, and the two elements which could probably deliver as at least as effective in helping change the risk behaviours of children and adults, are getting parents and children to talk about what they're doing, and the other one doing something about this in subjects like ethics in the school. So that's mainly about the internet. And the other topic I wanted to go on, I'll just round off this particular area. So there, if you want to, after the event, this is a bit worrying for school teachers. Where do kids most frequently learn about whether they get their help from? Primarily from friends, schoolmates, parents. Again, that's remarkably high. I'm not sure whether I have my doubts as to whether that figure really is quite so high. Trial and error. And after trial and error come teachers. So they come as a rather poor fourth along with just about the same level as brothers and sisters. So that's we're doing all right, but I think we could probably do better. Even if the teaching styles in the Nordic countries that were fairly informal, and it's one of the aims that we can engage our students, and that they end up trusting us as human beings, and we're not just authoritarian figures who are not approachable. We try to be approachable as teachers, but you can see we're not being all that successful if they don't really want to talk to us. Well, maybe it's part and parcel of being an adolescent. You don't really want to consort with the olders, the wrinklies they are after, or a different generation. We can skip over that. And just to make some conclusions, draw some conclusions. So we can certainly say that information communication technologies are now widely available. This has happened in the last 10 years. For real, anyway, for the population at large. Children and adolescents are heavy users of a wide range of information and communication technologies, as well as traditional media out of school. I think we can also claim, certainly in many countries, that the ICT use in school is outshadowed by what goes on outside school. Certainly in terms of the amount of time they spend on it, but maybe in terms of the kinds of things they're doing, they're probably more exploratory, more adventuresome outside of school. And all this has taken place in less than a decade. So if we've had some sort of professional training as teachers and it's more than 10 years old, then this shows that in-service teacher training really has got its work cut out for it. If we've got to help a corpus of teachers come to terms with a very different reality. And I think from a cultural point of view, it's interesting, and something needs to be done about the fact that the narrative appeal of a book seems to be under pressure. And that's why it's so encouraging that things like Harry Potter do in fact get the hype that we've seen even in certainly in Hong Kong. It's certainly the case that Harry Potter is widely read. I mean, I think the sale of Harry Potter in Denmark is something like 700,000 copies. So there's probably a copy in 35% of Danish homes. I don't think the figure's quite as high in Hong Kong, because you've also got Harry Potter, these Chinese lookalikes, because certainly over the border in the mainland, I don't think they could afford to pay what Harry the original actually costs. So you have these plagiarized versions, which you can find under the counter in some bookshops in Kowloon. So we have a problem, Houston. If we're in education, I think we certainly need to take a closer look at what's happening. And the second question I wanted to talk more briefly about, I think it's not quite so critical here, but I've written more about it in the Word file, which you can download as well. What impact does this have on the cognitive and effective development of our students? Well, we've been talking about the web, but we're also talking about games, and certainly the household penetration of different kinds of consoles is quite high in Hong Kong. It's probably around 40%. So about five of you have had to read this when you've had courses with me. For those who want to look at European research in this field, this is one of the best works of its kind. Hard going because it's so concentrated, but I was going to go on to look at again Harry Potter and PlayStation versions and DVD versions of Harry Potter and CD-ROM versions of Harry Potter. The whole business of what do we know about games and playing games and its impact on children and adults. I mean, they're quite widespread. We've got, again, DVDs, and we've got things like simulators, which, judging from a cable channel which I saw last night called Now, a PCCW cable channel which is also on broadband, they have a program every night reviewing different kinds of games. But this is a simulator for gliding, and there are a huge number of flight simulators. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence that using a simulator actually develops visual acuity, so that you can actually transfer your improved lateral vision to driving and to even flying jet planes. But it turns out it's only for the first couple of days, but even so, there is some basic skills which are being developed. And if we look at this is the last time I did, it was about 5 or 6 months ago, the top rated games titles. I had to choose the UK rather than Denmark, because otherwise you couldn't read it. So these are the kinds of games with the highest score. So FIFA 2003, this is a simulation of how to run a football club. So you're the manager of a football club. Here you've got something building on traditional fiction, Robin Hood. This is again some sort of adventure game, and Jeopardy is just based on a TV format. I don't think that's got necessarily the same redeeming features as certainly the FIFA. And then we've also got something like Sims, which SimCity has been around for a long time. That's now in an online version. If you look at things like the FIFA Soccer Manager, and I did this 6 years ago with two young nephews who at that time were 10 and 12, well, they'd actually spent about 200 hours working through the Argentine version of the FIFA Soccer Manager 1998 with their club, which was Boca Juniors. And they'd actually moved the club into, you know, 3 or 4 years into the future. Byproducts of actually using this game were that they were scrupulously careful to make backups, because they'd spent at one point nearly 200 hours doing this over a period of 6 months, and they wanted to make perfectly sure that their hard work didn't get lost by mistake. The elder of the two brothers was actually looking in the newspaper, looking up the stock market price for shares in that particular club, and I even saw them on occasion pick up a dictionary because they were looking at something to do with Manchester United, and there was something that they didn't really quite understand, so they actually went away because it was so important and used a good old-fashioned dictionary. So here we had something that grabbed their attention. I would say it's a good example of learning by stealth. The fact that they were motivated, the activity kept their, offered something and maintained some sort of promise and was delivering on that promise meant that they were getting some general insights as to the kinds of issues that a club manager of a professional football team actually has to face, because you've got a certain amount of money. One of the activities, should I modernise the bars or should I increase the parking spaces outside the stadium? These are real world challenges, and at certain points this kind of thing actually gets interesting in particular for boys, it seems. BECTA is a British institution which looks at education, and they did a study about 18 months ago on emotions and learning, and they were looking at the impact of, well, how can you go about building on the motivating aspect qualities of games. And so certainly they do have these qualities. They're provoking, and they went on to say that that in the same paper which is mentioned in the article I wrote, there are some very tangible suggestions about how you can go about either reusing existing games, or if you want to apply that kind of approach, what the implications are for you as an educationalist. But in some cases it may be not necessary to go out and try and do games yourself, but perhaps in class have a session where you discuss different kinds of games and the implications of playing different kinds of games, because for example girls tend to do more collaborative games, and certainly in Denmark if teenagers want to go out, if a group of boys want to make sure the girls want to go with them, they go back and do something like Tetris. So there's a common denominator, and boys and girls will then get involved in things of that kind, or SimCity or something of that kind. One of the problems to do with research in this field, though, is that most of it has overgeneralizes. It's overstates its results. So the conclusions they draw are not necessarily ones which can be supported by the empirical work they've done. And certainly we've got some games researchers in Denmark that they find it very difficult to draw any general conclusions about the impact of games and negative social behaviour. We had this concern in the 50s, 60s and 70s when it came to violence, the portrayal of violence in television. But again, much of the research, I'm afraid, seems to have been rather poorly done. So even if it is poorly done, we can take in mind the fact, or keep in mind that there could be risk, and there seem to be risk primarily for maladjusted individuals. The common sense of a relatively well-functioning kid in school is such that they're very clear about what's reality, what isn't. This doesn't necessarily apply, of course, to very small kids. And again, I've seen things like children even watching television, watching Ninja Turtles or a Japanese cartoon series, simply petrified with fear, because, you know, a three-year-old is watching something where they're out of their depth, but they're sitting on their own watching television. So that kind of situation can be problematic. But generally speaking, anything which involves some sort of mediation with either other kids or adults can invariably be turned to something quite positive. And one of the few areas we've got research which indicates that games do have an impact is neurophysiological studies, which indicate some sort of addiction. you can actually build up dopamine levels from playing games for extended periods. So you can actually get a high and then need to come back and play games again because you've got into the habit of producing more dopamine, more natural stimulants than you would otherwise do. But generally, this is an area where careful and considered research is in fact needed. It needs to be done better done than it has been done to date. This is a report produced for the US Congress, which said this guy, Goldstein, 3 years ago, nearly every study suffers from unclear definitions of violence and aggression, ambiguous measurements, or using questionable measures of aggression, such as blasts of noise or self-reports of prior aggression, and overgeneralizations from the data. In reality, a game player chooses when and what to play and enters into a different state of mind than someone who is required to play on demand. So your sense of reality, your sense of virtuality, different layers being, it's a bit like reality being an onion where you can peel off the different layers. I would think that our youngsters are pretty adept at sensing where they are relating to all kinds of electronic media. So unless there's something seriously wrong with them already, I would tend to give them the benefit of the doubt. And for those of you, we've got a whole group of educationists doing research into qualitative and more quantitative research in this particular area. You can see this later on. Just to point out that this is an area of concern, and therefore we do have some people doing research here. So, out-of-school media use has a variety of learning outcomes about which we still know too little. It's a bit tantalizing. We've got anecdotal evidence. We don't have in a solid body of knowledge about this, but we have a lot of anecdotal evidence to indicate this. And there are a lot of positive outcomes. There are also some dubious ones, which again can be mediated by by making sure that, in particular, kids and young adults do things together. And if they do so, there's a greater chance there'll be some degree of reflection than if they're working on their own. And just the last bit, which we can do fairly quickly, what are the implications of all this for educational policy and practice? Well, we've seen that quite a lot's happened in the last 10 years, and we can take games as an example. This is how the use of games has grown steadily, and it's still a minority interest in the US. So if we go back to 1980, those who played games at the time were in this particular group between 10 and 20. In 1990, it had gone from 10 to nearly 30. In 2000, down to 5 to 40. And it's thought that in 2005 games will be played, we're talking about electronic games, will be played by those between 5 and 45 largely. So we can see that if you start with games, over time many people continue to play games. They don't, it's in the past we would have gone on to do other things, but there still seem to be even lawyers and chemists and physicists and even teachers in their 40s having the occasional go at different kinds of video console games. Not so many women, but the same general trend. But the reason why not so many women is that we don't take women seriously enough when it comes to the kinds of games they would like to play. If we did, then people like Sony and Nintendo could make a killing. The only organization which ever took women seriously was in fact Sega. So they launched a console called Dreamcast and deliberately went for a more collaborative approach to gaming. But for economic reasons, they didn't reach their target of 10 million units by a given date, and they had to retrench, go back to just making games for others and concentrating on games arcades. So they didn't actually meet the threshold which would have allowed them to continue. But a number of my colleagues who actually work professionally with games are rather sad this took place, because Sega represented one of the first opportunities to broaden out the demographic appeal of games by actually doing different kinds of games. And if you've seen games, quite a lot's going to be happening in the next 3 or 4 years. Here are some new platforms on which games are being played. So these are figures from last year, from Europe again. Digital television, there was about $100 million worth of turnover on games being played, primarily in the UK but also in France. Quite simple platform games. This category, MOG, is massively online games. These are primarily a phenomenon from the US but also Korea. So the top five most played games are American or Korean. Some of these have got between 300,000 and 1 million regular players who actually in some cases subscribe and pay something like 15 to 25 Hong Kong dollars a month to continue as part of a massive online gaming community associated with these particular things. So that's the blue segment. The light grey is online console for those who've got an Xbox. In some territories there's now an internet connection and you can actually expand your games online. Sony will be doing the same with the next release of the PlayStation. This segment here is broadband, where we're actually delivering games over fat pipes. And the dark grey area is games on mobile platforms, so Java-based, not ones like mine because it's only black and white, but Java phones in particular already have quite a number of games. And again, if you go to Japan and Korea, you can see the taste of things to come. This, even in Europe, already has a significant turnover. It's not a huge amount compared with console games and CD-ROM games. But again, this is at the moment about 380 million. That's about 5% of the gaming market in Europe. And if we look at the growth just of these categories, it just to 2006, we're talking about nearly, multiply that by 24 billion Hong Kong dollars for online consoles. This figure, which would be about 17 billion Hong Kong dollars in Europe being spent on mobile games. And this is the most conservative forecast I can find. I can find some which are even more ridiculous, but this particular forecast explains the basis on which they've come up with these numbers, and we've looked at them very carefully. So if we've said that over the last 10 years we've seen the internet and computers, mobile phones, what we can claim is that it hasn't stopped, it's going to continue to change. There's just going to be more kinds of platforms, more kinds of probably more specialized platforms which combine all sorts of strange things like an MP3 player and a radio and a gaming element and perhaps a voice telephony thrown in. And I get a sense of what's the overall picture again for Europe. If we go from 2000 to 2010, one study which doesn't look too exaggerated is that if we've got about 3 hours of television viewing and about 6 minutes associated with other kinds of use of the television per day, that's to say PlayStation or using Teletext, that's a simple information service on on a TV. Over the in the course of the decade, overall television-based media consumption is going to creep up a bit, about 25%. There'll be some decrease in watching good old television programs, and a gradual increase in the use of interactive media and interactive services which are being delivered onto a television screen. Not necessarily through TV, because this could just as well be a broadband connection. I mean, we've now got Danish homes which have got 100 megabit or 300 megabit connections, so they get their digital TV through a cable, but it's a fibre cable, and they've got a fibre local area network at home which runs at 100 or 300 megabits. And you're paying $690 a month for, say, 30 TV channels and all of your telephony and 10 megabits which are dedicated just to your computer. And you can get films on demand for within about 3 seconds, which run a full quality, so DVD quality. So, out-of-school media use has changed rapidly and looks likely to continue. This change will continue. So there'll be usage patterns which will continue to evolve. And this is being driven by digitalization, convergence, and the ubiquitous nature of internet protocols. So what we regarded as separate entities in the past, over time will become more widespread, more persuasive or pervasive, depending on how you look at it. A wolf in sheep's clothing. And if we're saying this is fairly significant, such significant change in the course of just a decade, that's not even a generation. It's going a bit faster than many of the things we've seen in the past. It would seem that educational policy in the field of ICT would benefit from further studies of what's actually happening outside of school. If we're saying even among the adult population things are changing, and as children and adolescents seem to be early adopters, they tend to be the pioneers in the creative use of some of these things, it would probably be very useful for us if we could do this to look at media as a social phenomenon and look for pointers as to synergies between education and out-of-school use. We saw one in connection with risk behaviour. It seems important that as education now has to play an increasing part in the upbringing of kids, it's not just something that parents do on their own, but education also has to do its part. This could certainly be an area where we could get some more concrete information which we could then feed into educational policy. This is a repeat. And we need a more realistic policy regarding the protection of minors. Just take that up a bit. We need a more realistic protection policy for, which is not just based on filtering and rating of content, but trying to help parents also to get involved and also look at the creation of content and also looking at ways and means by which we could do, say, use what is often regarded by school children as a rather boring subject, ethics, actually taking some real world examples to help them to come to terms with this. But that needs a lot of lobbying on the part of educationists. It doesn't seem to be fully understood. So if it's not understood and it's not accepted, that just doing it without there being a consensus in favour of doing something different could in fact be quite difficult, judging from the headlines on Saturday. And I would say, to be a bit cheeky, parents still have responsibilities towards their children. They can't just outsource all their responsibilities to education. And I'm not talking here about Hong Kong, I'm talking about large parts of the industrialized world. If we really do care about our kids' well-being, then I think we'll have to spend a little bit more time in a more focused manner, in an undramatic fashion, just discussing some of the things that our kids find important on their terms, if we can over time build up a rapport where they feel like telling us what they're doing. This may not be possible, but I think we should at least have a go and try to do so. So, and if we want to use some of these very motivating devices like games and simulations, I think we should be aware of the fact that kids have an external yardstick. Regardless of what we're doing, television has always been the yardstick for when we were using video as a tool in schools. And in the same way, if we're using simulations and games in education, invariably our pupils, our students, will use what they see in the real world as a yardstick for whether they find it interesting or not. And if we're going to use that kind of mechanism, it really does have to grab their attention. If we do the job well, we can engage them, we can actually harness their interest, and their attention span can in fact be surprisingly long, but we're not always in our very top form, and we need to look at mechanisms by which we can improve the proportion of time we actually are in really good form. That's it. So...